All right, everybody. Welcome to another Options Discovery interview. Today, we are lucky enough to have the CIO of Option Solutions here with us, Michael Oyster. Just introduce yourself real quick and give us a quick background of your education and career path that led you to where you are today.
Yeah, Alex, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. So went to the University of Cincinnati for undergrad. After graduation, I started working in the options business for a guy named Bernie Schaefer, who you may know, kind of a legend in the options world and behavioral finance, really a pioneer in both of those areas. Spent 5 years with him, did a lot of quantitative research and a lot of trading. Went to work then for the institutional side of the world for an organization called Fund Evaluation Group, or FEG. Spent 19 years there, ended as chief investment strategist. At one point was the head of the investment group that was allocating multi-billion dollars in the form of outsourced CIO investment assets. So I've written two books on investment, various topics. Second one came out in 2018, and then got the opportunity to go to work for some really amazing people with Options Solutions, as you know, Bill Brodsky and Steve Sears and Bill Spath and others. So been enjoying that. It's almost been 3 years since we started working together. So it's been great.
Yeah, we've had a chance to talk to Bill and learn a little bit about what Options Solutions does. But as the CIO, you probably have your own perspective. So how does, Option Solutions, when I was reading about you guys and researching, you guys really bring an interesting investment philosophy, investment strategy to your clients. So how are you able to use what your background is in institutional side of the options world, using those sophisticated strategies? How are you able to bring those to your clients today?
Yeah, definitely. My prior life, everything was over a very long time horizon, multi years. And my perspective has always been at the 30,000 foot level, looking out, markets and histories and long-term trends and systematic things. And all of that is great background to bring to the options world. I think a lot of people look at the world of options and they see trading or, high frequency type transactions. And that's not what we do at all. We are very methodical in the way that we think about things, and we implement the same strategy consistently through time. And that sort of long-term mentality, I think, serves me well, because it's easy to get caught up in the short-termism of the markets, particularly when you're looking at things every day. Things are moving every day and it affects the options prices. But having a steady hand with a long-term perspective, I think, is really beneficial to me. I tell people all the time, what I do is more like farming than anything else. It's slow, it's methodical. Sometimes it goes in your favor, sometimes it doesn't, but you go out and you do the same thing day after day, and then good things will happen over a long period of time.
Yeah, and obviously for a long period of time in your career, you've been really looking at things, like you've said, from that 30,000 foot level. How has that affected the way that you look at the way you work today with individual investors, looking at the long-term trends, and how maybe that's more beneficial to people on the individual level than potentially, like you said before, doing a lot of those quicker trades?
Well, I mentioned before that I started to work right out of college for Bernie Schaefer, and I learned a lot about trader psychology and behavioral finance from him. And that's served me quite well, because I don't get caught up in short-term trends. I don't get emotional about transactions. Things go right sometimes, things go wrong sometimes. There's not a lot you can do except implement your strategy consistently through time. And I think as we look at individual portfolios, and most of the time, not always, but most of the time, we're putting on monthly positions that expire, and you kind of do that. That's a month is not a very long period of time. So that's really where our focus is on a day-to-day basis. But in the back of our minds, we always know that the long term is just a bunch of months daisy chained together. That's how we think about it. And I think it's, like I said, it's really easy to get caught up in the news cycle, but having that long-term perspective, I think, really helps us bring a unique way of managing money to our client accounts.
Yeah, because I feel like, it's really weird to think about options in a short-term nature, because unlike going long on a stock, the option expires at some point. So a lot of people get caught up in that short-term mentality. But the farming analogy is really good, because it's something that you do consistently over and over again. You can build income, hedge your risk, but it's not necessarily something that you always need to think about short term in the moment, getting caught up in the whims of the day-to-day market.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's absolutely how we think about the world.
Well, that kind of leads us into our main part of the interview. So today we're going to be talking about using options as a tool for risk management, which is, I guess, right up Option Solutions alley. So the first question I have is, obviously, this interview spawned from a great article you did on Forbes with Larry Light. If anyone's watching this, definitely go check that out. But one of the topics you discussed was about modern portfolio theory, which is the theory of being able to diversify your portfolio to an optimal risk return level. And so what you were saying in that article was sometimes using volatility as a measure of risk can be misleading, especially when you know, a lot of investors are conflating, you know, volatility with risk. And that obviously kind of leads into that short-term mentality we're talking about. Can you explain a little bit more of what you meant when you said these things?
Yeah, sure. So Harry Markowitz justifiably won the Nobel Prize for his work on modern portfolio theory back in the 1950s. He didn't win the prize then, obviously, but that's when the work was done. And that brought a whole new method and methodology to institutional investment portfolio construction. It's truly brilliant, truly groundbreaking. One of the common criticisms of modern portfolio theory is that the measure that it uses for risk is volatility. Now, statistically, that makes all the sense in the world. Practically, does it make sense? People don't really care about volatility on the upside. What they care about is volatility on the downside. I firmly believe that volatility is not synonymous with risk. Rather, risk is really the permanent impairment of capital. That's what people care about. They don't care about the short-term fluctuations, or at least they shouldn't. Many do, but you shouldn't. You should really care about the risk of permanent impairment of capital, which is to say something goes down in value and it stays there. It doesn't recover back up. That's when it really starts to hurt. That's the kind of risk that we have to protect against. And options afford us a great opportunity to hedge that risk with very prescriptive type strategies that can be exactly what an investor needs to protect against over the exact period of time over which they need to protect it.
Yeah, and that kind of leads into, how do you believe that options should be used in a risk management setting if we have to think about the dichotomy between volatility and the impairment of capital?
Sure. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time both in the institutional world and then more recently with Option Solutions talking to people about hedging risk and how to use options to do that. The simplest thing you can do is just go into the market and buy some put options, right? I mean, put options go up when whatever the underlying it is goes down. All things being equal, puts are extremely expensive. And right now, if you look at the VIX above its long-term average, they're exceptionally expensive relative to history, even by its own standards. So what we do is, you know, in general terms, we want to buy the puts, we just don't want to pay for them. So what we'll do is we'll sell call options out of the money and offset the cost of the puts such that the investor on day one pays nothing out of pocket, has the risk protection that they're looking for. So you say, well, what's the downside of that? Well, the problem is where you sell that call option, if the underlying security goes above that, you don't get any more than that, all else being equal. There's ways of mitigating that, of course, but you know, that's sort of the trade-off. You're willing to give up some upside in order to get the downside protection for free.
Yeah, and when it comes to Option Solutions, one of the things that you guys definitely, you know, advertise to your investors is that not only are you able to hedge a lot of the risk that they have, but you're also able to generate income on assets that they already hold. Can you explain a little bit more of how you do that as well?
Sure, absolutely. So we've got a variety of different clients that we work with a variety of different needs, risk tolerances, goals, objectives, what have you. Some of our clients bring us concentrated stock positions. They were an executive at a publicly traded company. Part of their compensation package was in the form of stock. It's extremely low tax basis and they never want to sell it, but it's just sitting there, not doing anything for them. So what we offer is a value proposition to them is to say, okay, if you're going to just keep this stock and you're never going to lose it, we can sell call options on it and generate a little bit of income such that it either replaces a dividend that doesn't exist for that particular stock, or it replicates or ideally exceeds the value of the dividend. So they're generating a little bit more income. One of the other things that we've done a lot of is clients will come to us and say, well, I've got this concentrated stock position, but I do want to sell it. I want to divest of it, but I need to do it in a responsible, structured way. So then what I'll do is I'll create a program that says, all right, if the stock goes up by a certain amount, you can sell a little bit of that. And I mean, that's just good fundamental investing right there, right? I mean, if you're going to divest of the stock, why not put in a position that says when it goes up in value, I'll sell it there. And oh, by the way, the client gets paid to wait until it gets sold. It's a great thing to do. So we do a lot of that. We've got some model portfolios that we've developed that screen stocks according to the price of the option relative to its fair value. So we're looking for our options that are systematically overpriced relative to what the volatility of the underlying says that they should be. Those are juicy options to sell. And we use that to help our clients generate income from stocks that they hold.
Yeah. And one of the things that I thought was interesting, I guess I'm kind of pulling reference from my interview with Bill Brodsky, was that you guys are actually able to kind of create these strategies on stocks that maybe aren't the most popular in the options market, being able to create markets for covered calls on stocks that are not necessarily very popular or don't necessarily have a lot of volume traded. So can you explain a little bit about that process as well?
Yeah, for sure. A lot of investors who are just operating in the stock market, and particularly the most liquid names like the S&P 500 names, for example, don't ever think about the issue of liquidity. But it's a big deal in the options market. And if a stock is thinly traded, if the stock doesn't have a lot of liquidity, chances are, if it does have listed options on it, those options will be fairly illiquid as well. So when the market makers offer the opportunity to buy or sell those options, the spread between the bid and the ask is very wide. If you want to buy it, sure, here's the price. You're going to have to pay well over fair value to do that. So we're really cognizant of that. We've got models that we can look at that tell us what the true theoretical value of it is. But even that is sometimes leaves us short. What we do is, you know, we work with our brokers to build the market slowly. We've got relationships with liquidity traders and others in the marketplace who have a good feel for what's available. And, you know, we're as transparent as possible with these folks, and just to say, here's what we're going to do. We want to make a position in this. We want to build it up slowly over time. And we look at it more as a partnership as opposed to a fist fight between us and the markets. I do think that if you just went out and started blasting orders for some of these things, your clients would be very disappointed and underserved. So I think it's a responsibility that we have to be thoughtful and prudent about how we execute in the marketplace.
Yeah. And it's definitely very interesting. It's not a strategy that we hear often. I know a lot of times when people traditionally think about options trading, right? It's a lot of it's high speed, a lot of it's commoditized, but it's very interesting to think about the long-term approach and the dichotomy between using options as risk management, maybe using it to divest from certain assets while also generating income as well. That's very interesting. And then one thing about this show is that we cover a lot of option strategies for beginners. You kind of mentioned a put strategy I used earlier. I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail on how a put protection strategy is implemented.
Sure. Yeah. A lot of what we find is that it's probably overly simplistic to say, okay, let's just put in a floor on a particular level of the market or a stock and say, okay, that's, we don't want to go below that. In reality, most of the time, stocks and markets don't go to zero. What you really need is a range of protection. So maybe you accept the first, let's just take the S&P 500 using spiders, for example. Let's say an investor is willing to accept a 10% decline. Quite frankly, if you can't accept a 10% decline, you probably shouldn't be a stock investor to begin with, and that's okay. But let's say you accept the first 10%, then we put in a floor down to 30%, for example. And then if it drops below 30%, then you start participating again. But what you've done is you've cut out the biggest, most highest probability area of where the bottom in the market might be. And it's okay to give up, you know, some additional downside to there. So you've got one long put, one short put, and the cost of that is then offset by a call option that can be pretty far above the current level of the market, say 12 or 15% even. Well, if an investor who has a long-term perspective looks at the market, they may say, 15% is pretty good when the long-term average is almost 10. It's hard for us to kind of wrap our brains around that, since the stock market performance in the last, call it several decades even, has been far greater than history up to that point. So if you're willing to accept that you won't get anything more than 15, you can build a range of protection for no out of pocket cost. And I think that's a compelling value proposition for people.
Yeah. So you're essentially giving up the potential for unlimited upside. So you're capping your upside, but you're also protecting yourself on the downside as well. So it's a creative way of being able to protect yourself for essentially not that much cost at all.
Yeah. And relative to the underlying index, you end up with a lower volatility payoff over longer periods of time. So you can do that for 6 months to a year, and then another 6 months to a year, another 6 months to a year. When you string all of those together, your total return is actually, in most cases, going to be lower volatility and certainly less risk. And, you know, granted, what we think we're looking at in terms of the markets going forward, and I've written about this extensively, is an environment where stocks are probably not going to do 10 to 15% a year. Maybe 5 to 8% is more realistic. If that's the case, that doesn't mean that the volatility of the markets are going to be any less. So a strategy like that can be very appealing to people willing to give up anything above 15, but having that range of protection on the downside. It helps people sleep at night.
Yeah, and it seems like it's also a strategy that bridges the dichotomy between what you were talking about earlier, volatility, and the risk of permanent capital impairment. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, why it's important to think about both aspects when you're, you know, setting up these trades for the long term, especially in the options market?
Yeah, sure. So again, I think there's and behavioral finance has done a lot of work on this subject. You know, thinking about the world from Harry Markowitz's perspective versus what the real world perspective is. And it is interesting. It is a dichotomy. And I think, like I said, statistically, standard deviation makes all the sense in the world. But there's a reason why there's things like the Trainer ratio that people look at that just looks at downside deviation and, you know, risk of loss. Max drawdown is another statistic that people look at sometimes that gives, you know, really cuts to the heart of what people care about, which is loss. I've been talking a lot about behavioral finance, but it's one of my favorite things to talk about. And there's a concept called prospect theory. And what prospect theory says is that human beings feel more pain from loss than they do satisfaction from gains. So you can imagine if you bought a stock, it goes up 10%, and you may say, "Wow, Alex, I'm brilliant." You know, pat yourself on the back, but you don't get super excited about it. If it goes down 10% and it sits there, it's going to eat at you every day. You're going to drive yourself crazy because you can't believe the fact that it's just sitting there. So you feel more pain from loss than you do satisfaction from gain. And that's why I think standard deviation being both up and down is inadequate as a measure of risk. And as we think about what we're doing and what options afford our clients the opportunity to do, is to protect against the risk of the thing they really care about, which is loss. And it's not loss for the short term that's then going to stop, you know, strike back. It's recognizing that if the stock or the index never comes back, it's always a possibility, then I'm protected no matter what.
Yeah, and I think it's super interesting. Can you talk a little bit more about how the emotional, potentially the emotional security of your clients is also an important priority? Because it seems like that's something that your strategies, the option solution, actually end up providing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the biggest part about that is education. You know, I commend you for what you're doing, you know, getting the word out in terms of options education. That's the biggest hurdle that we, you know, it's not the trading, it's not the investment ideas. Anybody could do that. I mean, we're really good at that, obviously, but the biggest challenge that we run into is getting investors comfortable with options as a strategic investment. And that's a hard story to tell. People don't oftentimes look at options. I just, by my own estimate, I'm guessing that in college, I probably spent a week on options. That's all I got, right? So I've had to learn through, you know, postgraduate studies and CFA work and all the rest. But, you know, getting a client comfortable with it means that they're going to recognize that there's these short-term peaks and valleys that, you know, what you really care about, again, back to the same subject, is over the long period of time, continue to do what you're doing. And you know, providing the clients comfort and, you know, giving them an opportunity to feel like they're part of the process because they understand it and they're comfortable with it. Not only do they then become good clients, they become advocates for us and the options market in general. We've seen that with many of our clients go out to their friends and say, hey, look at what I'm doing in this, you know, it's not risky. It's not, you know, rocket science. It's not voodoo magic. It's just some really good structural type investing. And having people that understand that, I think, calms their fears. And it's all about education. And it's a really important thing about, really important part about what we do.
Yeah. And I feel like a big part of that is you're very diligent about setting the risk parameters for your strategies for your clients. And it's definitely something that enhances their portfolio, not necessarily takes it into deep speculative waters.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think the other part of that, Alex, is just managing expectations up front. I mean, we are not, if you're looking for, you know, triple your money inside of 3 weeks, that's not us. I mean, we're going to try to provide clients with good risk protection and additional income on assets that they already own. That's who we are. So managing the expectations right up front with any new relationship, I think, is critical.
Yeah. And so we're coming close to the closing part of the interview. So I have some questions for you that I usually end every guest with. And one of the first ones is, you actually talked earlier in the interview about some of the mentors that you've had. And what are some of the most important lessons that you learned either from them or on your own in terms of the options industry?
Yeah, for sure. So Bernie Schaefer was definitely a mentor of mine in the options business, as was Price Heedley. I give them a great deal of credit for introducing me to options, which, again, I knew nothing about when I started. Chris Meyer is a guy who hired me at FEG and has taught me over the years about being long-term, being consistent. It's just sort of that farming analogy. That mentality came from him. I have a great deal of respect for Rob Arnott. I've met him a number of times with research affiliates. Cliff Asness of AQR. I had an opportunity to meet Ken French one time. I've had, you know, Charlie Ellis. I met him. He signed my book for me as I quoted him in the book. So that was fun. But yeah, a lot of these guys that have been at it for a long time and just do the same thing. You know what you're good at, right? And don't try to be something that you're not. That's, I think, a lot of the mentors and people that I admire in the business have been very consistent about who they are and what they do, and they don't deviate from it. They don't try to be all things to all people. And I think that's what, you know, lesson that I learned personally. Another thing, when you asked about lessons learned, the first thing that popped into my mind is when I was the head of the investment effort at FEG, we had a position that had currency risk on, and it really went badly. And one lesson that I learned from that was that when you're an investor, you have to take risk. And if you want better returns, you generally have to take more risk, but it's not necessarily a one-for-one trade-off. You've got to be able to determine whether the risk that you're taking is justified by a commensurate amount of return. Otherwise, you shouldn't take the risk. And I think that's the lesson that I've learned, is that, yeah, you can take risk, and risk is important and risk is necessary to get return, but it has to be justified by a commensurate amount of expected return. And if it's not, you shouldn't take it.
Yeah. And I feel like that's something that we always hear as university students in finance and investments, theoretically, right? You need to find that all investors are risk averse, and you should, you know, only take risk if you're compensated for it. But the practical implementation, that's a different story. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Nobody wants to take risk. Yeah. Nobody wants to take risk. Everybody wants to have the 10 to 15% return with no risk of the downside. And it's, there's no free lunch, right? I mean, we all have to recognize that. But it is, it's why we get paid, why we do what we do, is to try to find, you know, the nuances in those opportunities that present themselves. There are some that are structural, there are some that are opportunistic, you know, and finding those and being able to take advantage of them when the opportunities present themselves is important. But I think at the end of the day, you just have to be comfortable. You have to understand what risk you're comfortable with. Like I said before, if you're not able to take a 10% decline in the stock market, you shouldn't be a stock market investor. So that happens fairly frequently, right? I mean, we've just seen it not very long ago this year. So, and even 20%. So I think it's just recognizing yourself, recognizing your own personal risk sensitivities, and aligning your investment strategy with those things.
Yeah. And in the same vein of that, and of options education in general, every week we choose a new topic for the show. So this week we were talking about using options as a tool for risk management and an alternative way to think about risk. And that's why we brought you on the show. So is there a topic that you recommend that we cover in the future?
Boy, no, that's a good question. I think, look, options to me represent the single most important untapped resource available to investors today. And most people either have had a bad experience with options and they just dismiss them out of hand, or they find them to be so complicated that they don't even want to touch them. It just makes their brain hurt thinking about it. I would think what techniques the people who are successful at educating clients, educating investors on options, how do they do it? What types of stories are there? Analogies? You know, there was an options person I met years ago that used an analogy of covered call writing that made it sound like an apartment complex. You know, maybe is there an analogy? Is there a graphic visual that makes people understand and become comfortable? I would think there's a great opportunity to talk about what kinds of things are out there. What types of things are people finding successful in terms of education? How do you get the story across? How do you get people comfortable with the concept? I'd love to learn more about that myself.
Yeah, I think that's a really important subject, actually, because we do have a lot of people on the show that have an education background, especially when it comes to options. And it would definitely be interesting to see, you know, where are people finding traction in terms of explaining to clients that may be a little bit scared of, you know, the concept of putting their money into options and using it as a tool. But like a lot of things in the investment world, it is a tool and you can use it properly or you can use it improperly.
Yep. It's like electricity, right? We need to have electricity, but you don't want to put your finger into the socket either, right?
There you go. There's a good analogy right there. The last thing that we'd like to end off on is just kind of a more, it's less investment heavy and just more of a personal fun fact question. So what are some of the things that you do outside of the office, outside of work, that keep you motivated for your work at Option Solutions?
Yeah, my kids, mostly. I think, you know, just the other night, my son, who's a junior in high school, wanted to learn more about what I do. And that was a talk about being motivated. I had to really sit and think about, you know, how can I explain this in a way that he can understand? I try to use the analogy of coupons. Like options are like coupons. It gives you the opportunity to buy something at a certain price before a certain period of time. He seemed to understand that a little bit. You know, I try to find things to read that are not finance and investment related. Maybe some science fiction to, you know, spark the creativity, keep that side of my brain going. Sometimes I make electronic music on the computer, which is fun. That's something that keeps me motivated. But yeah, I just think doing what we do and caring so much about our clients and what we're doing, I think that's the biggest motivation of all. It's really personal to us. I mean, we do a daily call with our investment team, and every one of us is just deeply committed to the success of our clients. And it gets sometimes even a little bit emotional, just making sure that we're doing everything we can in our power to do the best we can for them. And that's huge motivation.
Well, that was a great answer. And that is all the questions I have today for the interview. When it comes to some of the things that you've done, like your books, where can we find that?
Yeah, so it's on Amazon. If you look for my name, Michael Oyster, the name of the book is Success in a Low Return World. And I think it's can be particularly helpful in the current environment with interest rates moving up. That's kind of the premise of the book, is that the duration tailwind we've seen for the last 40 years is gone. There's an opportunity for investors to think differently. And then, of course, optionssolutions.com is where they can find everything about Options Solutions, about the team and what we do. And, you know, of course, I'm on LinkedIn as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Michael. We really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your knowledge with us. And that is going to be it for today.
Great. Thanks, Alex. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye.
If you're hungry for more options content, make sure to subscribe to the JLN YouTube channel and check out our social media accounts. Be sure to check out our website, johnlothiannews.com, MarketsWiki, and the John Lothian newsletter for more content.